The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
I'm Mo Rocca, and I've got a brand new podcast. It's all about the people who have long fascinated me. The one thing they've got in common? They're all dead. The name of my brand new podcast? Mobituaries. From the 20th century's greatest entertainer.
He was everything. I mean, he could play any instrument. He could dance like a maniac.
To the founding father, who just doesn't seem to get much respect.
This guy did everything wrong. So there's no statue, there's no signature on the Declaration of Independence.
You'll learn new things about people you thought you knew.
Were you aware that the day of your inauguration, Audrey Hepburn died?
No.
You'll learn about people who aren't real.
They did not have room in the writing for the older brother because the Fonz became the older brother.
So join me this premiere season of Mobituaries.
From the Capital One Bank studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the program, the explosive Gayle King interview with R. Kelly.
I gave him 30 years of
Robert.
30 years of my career!
A firestorm on Capitol Hill over a lawmaker's remarks about Israel.
I don't think that that the congresswoman is perhaps appreciate the full weight of how it's heard by other people.
And Alex Trebek is treating a life-threatening disease as anything but final jeopardy.
This week, I was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer.
I'm Bill Rakoff in the CBS News Washington Bureau.
I thought I might get accidentally clobbered, but I didn't think that he would deliberately try to hurt me. I never felt in danger talking to him.
That's CBS This Morning anchor Gayle King, fresh off her explosive interview on CBS This Morning with R. Kelly, the entertainer. Shortly after the interview, court officers in Chicago arrested Kelly following a hearing over unpaid child support bills. Authorities say he will stay in jail until he comes up with more than $161,000 that he owes to his three children. Tuesday, the embattled R&B singer spoke with Gayle for nearly 80 minutes, saying all of the women now accusing him of physical and sexual abuse are lying.
Have you ever had sex with anyone under the age of 17?
No.
Never?
No.
I have to tell you, it's so hard to believe that based on all that we've read.
I'm going to tell you something, Gayle. There's one
situation.
I'm going to tell you something.
What women said about you.
What women said about me. What women. So nobody's allowed to be mad at me and be scorned and lie on me.
So they're lying on you. That's your explanation. They're lying on you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You feel that people have maligned your character?
I have been assassinated. I have been buried alive. But I'm alive.
So I think the point you're making is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you have never held anybody against their will.
I don't need to. Why would I?
Well, I'm
how stupid would it be for R. Kelly, with all I've been through in my way, way past, to hold somebody, let alone 4, 5, 6, 50, you said. How stupid would I be to do that?
I didn't say you were holding...
That's stupid, guys! Is this camera on me?
Yes, it's on.
That's stupid! Use your common sense. Don't... Forget the blogs. Forget how you feel about me. Hate me if you want to. Love me if you want. But just use your common sense. How stupid would it be for me to, with my crazy past and what I've been through, right now I just think I need to be a monster and hold girls against their will, chain them up in my basement, and don't let them eat and don't let them out unless they need some shoes down the street from their uncle.
Robert,
stop it. Y'all quit playing. Quit playing.
Robert.
I didn't do this stuff. This is not me. I'm fighting for my life. Y'all killing me with this. I gave y'all 30 years of my career.
Robert.
30 years of my career. Y'all trying to kill me. You killing me, man. This is not about music. I'm trying to have a relationship with my kids, and I can't do it. Y'all just don't want to believe the truth. You don't want to believe it.
R. Kelly was CBS This Morning's Gayle King, who spoke about the experience on the program.
He felt that in his mind, everybody's lying. I said, but there's so many people who are telling the same story. And he kept going back. I said, but the women don't know each other. And he said, how do you know they don't know each other? On social media, you're connected. He thinks everybody's trying to do a book deal or they're trying to do a movie.
Was she concerned at all about her safety during the interview?
Well, it's funny. A favorite son, favorite daughter, and Oprah all called me and said, were you afraid? Did you think he was going to hit you? I actually never thought that. I think that he was, I thought I might get accidentally clobbered, but I didn't think that he would deliberately try to hurt me. I never felt in danger talking to him. I just felt that he had a lot of emotion. He wanted to release it. And, you know, when it was all over, we had a conversation, we said goodbye, and I think at the end of the day, he was glad that he was able to say what he wanted to say.
Meanwhile, two women who live with R. Kelly are defending him and their relationship with him. Azriel Clary and Jocelyn Savage, 21 and 23 respectively, told Gail King that they love Kelly even though their families claim he's brainwashed them.
What is your relationship, both of you, with R. Kelly?
We're with him. That's our relationship.
We're with him. Yeah, that's what it is.
And we're in a relationship with him.
Right.
You just said it.
A very strong relationship as well.
Both of you?
Yes, most definitely.
Should your parents be concerned?
No.
Why?
Well, my parents knew where I've always been for 4 years. They have known. They know that I've been well taken care of.
They never thought you were missing, Azriel. They just were wondering if you were okay.
Well, my parents have actually came to Chicago and seen me a few times. I've talked to them. They stopped answering my calls.
You know what they say? They say that you are brainwashed. I talked to your dad last night. He says, my daughter is brainwashed, and he's very concerned. He said he was here 2 days ago, and you wouldn't even look him in the eye.
Okay, I wouldn't look him in the eye because he's a liar, and he's a manipulative liar.
I'll tell you why they're concerned, Azriel, because they say she's 17. We found text messages that indicated that she was having sex with R. Kelly when she was 17. Is that true?
No, that is a lie. That is a lie. I was not having sex with him at 17.
Why would they want to lie about you, their daughter?
Okay, so when I first met Robert, my parents told me to lie about my age. So when I met him, he thought that I was 18. On top of that, when I was 17, my parents were actually making me, trying to get me to take photos with him, take sexual videos with him, all kinds of stuff.
Wait. Your parents encouraged you to do sexual videos with R. Kelly?
Yes. And they said because if they ever have to blackmail him, what they're trying to do now, they can use it against him, which is exactly what they're doing.
This is the first time hearing, to be honest with you, that your parents are trying to get money from R. Kelly.
Okay.
Because your father told a very different story to me last night.
Yeah, he's the manipulative. He's very manipulative, so he's the one you need to watch out for. But my dad and my mom, they started to send threats to both me and him. They said, I'll put all your naked pictures all over the world. I'm going to ruin you. I'm going to ruin him. If he doesn't send $20,000 to this bank account by Monday, I'm going to put everything out there and then $10,000 after that. You're trying to solicit me like I'm some f***ing hoe. I'm not. I'm your child.
Exactly.
Yeah, you sound very angry with your parents. Tell me, Azriel, why you're crying. Tell me.
I'm crying because you guys don't know the truth. You guys believe in some facade that our parents are saying. This is all lies for money. And if you can't see that, you're ignorant and you're stupid as because you want to be. All because that's the world we live in. Negativity sells.
Exactly.
Gossip is what sells.
Exactly.
Rumors are what sells.
Exactly.
But Jocelyn and Azriel, this is more than gossip. This is more than just rumors. These are decades of allegations against Robert Kelly.
We're not here to talk about decades. We're here to talk about what our parents are doing right now.
Right.
And what they're doing right now is all for money.
You can hear more of Gail's interviews at CBSNews.com. Still to come, a wild week in Washington. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff. Turning to politics now, CBS News learned this week that former Vice President Joe Biden is likely to enter the 2020 presidential race. More from CBS News political correspondent Ed O'Keefe.
We're in the final stages of that decision.
The former vice president is expected to launch his presidential campaign next month. People familiar with his plans tell CBS News he's putting the finishing touches on a campaign team and strategy.
I want to make sure that if we do this, and we're very close to getting to a decision, that I am fully prepared to do it.
If he jumps in, Biden would be joining a crowded field that already includes 14 Democrats. But several others said just this week that they're staying out, including Hillary Clinton, Mike Bloomberg, and Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley.
The best contribution I can make is by working to make the Senate a full partner in this bold agenda to save America.
Just today, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, who had generated some buzz for a candidacy, said he had decided to forego a run. Early polls show Biden would start the race at the top, where he's never been before in a presidential race. He sputtered out of the 1988 campaign amid a plagiarism scandal and dropped out of the 2008 race after finishing far back in the Iowa caucus. He didn't run in 2016 in part because of the death of his son, Beau. Because this time, Biden could be quickly cast as out of touch with today's Democratic Party as voters scrutinize his four-decade Senate record. He's already apologized for his handling of Anita Hill during the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court confirmation hearings and for his support of tough-on-crime legislation in the 1990s.
We must make the streets safer.
I know we haven't always gotten things right, but I've always tried.
One other potential challenge, for a Democratic Party increasingly relying on younger, female, and minority voters, Biden is a 76-year-old white man. If he wins the White House, he'd replace President Trump as the nation's oldest ever president.
That's CBS's Ed O'Keefe. It was a stormy week on Capitol Hill as House leaders tried to address anti-Semitism after comments made by freshman Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. But leaders wound up with more than they bargained for. Here's CBS's Nancy Cordes.
I know what intolerance looks like.
The latest comment to land Omar in hot water was this one she made at a D.C. bookstore slamming congressional support for Israel.
I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country.
In response, her own party drafted a four-page resolution rejecting anti-Semitism. Without mentioning Omar by name, it says her comment suggests that Jews cannot be patriotic Americans and trusted neighbors. New Jersey Democrat Josh Gottheimer.
As someone who's Jewish, the idea that you would question my loyalty to the country as a lawmaker because of my religion is obviously offensive and deeply hurtful.
The president called it a dark day for Israel, and GOP leaders urged Democrats to go further.
Nancy Pelosi has to remove her from the Foreign Affairs Committee.
Speaker Pelosi shares the cover of this month's Rolling Stone with Omar, who is the nation's first Muslim congresswoman. But Pelosi also reprimanded Omar last month for a tweet about a Jewish lobbying group and money.
I posted a statement.
Omar says she's being held to a double standard. Just last week, a poster was erected in the West Virginia state capitol linking her with 9/11.
We get to be called names and we get to be labeled as hateful. No, we know what hate looks like. Yeah. We experience it every single day.
That's CBS's Ed O'Keefe. During a hearing on sexual assault in the military earlier this week on Capitol Hill, Senator Martha McSally of Arizona revealed before the Senate Armed Services Committee that she had been raped by a superior officer while serving in the Air Force. The military branch has since apologized to the 26-year veteran and the first female fighter pilot to fly combat missions. McSally sat down with CBS This Morning's Nora O'Donnell.
Like you, I am also a military sexual assault survivor.
Senator Martha McSally soared as America's first female fighter pilot to fly in combat, but faced dramatic lows after she says a superior officer raped her.
Honestly, I didn't even think about reporting it. That's kind of the environment we were in at the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
There's a lot of denial. There's a lot of confusion. You kind of, you know, just suck it up. It wasn't ever communicated necessarily.
You felt like you just had
way
to suck it up.
I felt like I didn't have any options at the time.
You noted, too, that you stayed silent for so long, but there was a point in your military career when you did tell others in the military. And what was their reaction?
Well, let me just say that I love our Air Force. I am proud to have served in the military. I am proud to have been given the opportunity to break through glass ceilings for women.
But McSally says she was disgusted by how the Air Force handled her case.
It was really junior varsity.
You said it was worse than that. You said you felt like the system was raping me all over again.
Interrogating me about what happened to you. Tell us what happened to you. And I was mortified. If that's the way you are treating being alerted that somebody who's been through something like this, who actually is trying to have our military succeed at dealing with it, and you bring me in and interrogate me as if I'm the perpetrator, even in the tone and the approach and just the ignorance, they failed on the job big time. I got up and left, and I dropped a bunch of swear words, just to be frank.
You say you almost left the military.
I did. I did. I really felt like the system victimized me again.
Reports of sexual assaults are up by 50% at U.S. service academies and nearly 10% in the military overall, a sign McSally says that more victims may feel comfortable coming forward.
Do you regret not reporting the assault?
I always, you know, like to look forward and not back. It's very difficult to put myself back into the shoes of where I was at the time.
So what about a young woman in the Air Force who may want to make a report? Can you say to her right now, do it?
Each person has to make their own decision.
But you're a sitting United States Senator.
I'm not going to compel
anybody. No, and you're on the Armed Services Committee, and you're a former fighter pilot.
Right.
To not be able to say, yes, we will protect you.
Of course I would want them to report it. Of course I would want the opportunity for immediately there to be an investigation that they can then quickly find justice for that victim. Of course that's what I want. I'm just saying I'm not going to tell a victim what to do.
Yeah. But can you say that you have confidence in the system? Right now.
Look, we have a lot of work to do. We do. We've got to stop the next assault from happening right now.
McSally wanted to be a doctor, but set her eyes on the sky when she was told the Air Force wouldn't allow female fighter pilots.
And it just pissed me off. And I said, that's exactly what I'm going to do.
Senator Martha McSally of Arizona with CBS's Nora O'Donnell. Coming up, we hear a lot about socialism in political discussion today, but what are we really talking about? We'll break it down. Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Bill Rakoff. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Every Sunday, Face the Nation brings you in-depth interviews with the biggest names in Washington.
Kellyanne Conway, Nancy Pelosi, Lindsey Graham, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
You'll never miss an episode with the weekly podcast from CBS News Radio. Tune in to hear moderator Margaret Brennan and the country's top policymakers discuss today's toughest issues.
What is going on? Is this political conspiracy or is this just incompetence?
The Face the Nation podcast. Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff. Socialism seems to be making a surge of late on the American political scene, but what exactly is it and how's it being applied in today's society? CBS News White House reporter Katie Watson has been researching this and joins us to talk about it. Thanks for joining us, Katie. Let's start with what the idea of socialism is all about.
Of course. Well, socialism, if there is a basic definition of it, and we can get into that more, is the government owning and operating the means of production, you know, kind of originated in Britain a couple of hundred years ago. We've seen many varied definitions and forms of it since. So there is not necessarily even today one agreed upon form of or definition, I should say, of socialism. So that is where we enter into the 2020 election here with Democrats, Democratic contenders, Democratic hopefuls really revitalizing this idea of what does socialism mean and what are some, if not socialist, very progressive policies that Americans might be open to.
So what are we talking about then when we talk about the likes of Rashida Tlaib and others who are saying that they espouse a certain type of a socialism in this country today? What are they talking about specifically?
Sure. Well, it seems that the type of socialism, if you will, that some of the very progressive candidates or members of Congress like Rashida Tlaib and like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are talking about is really a much more expanded social welfare state, if you will. Some wouldn't necessarily call it socialist. Republicans certainly would and will be using that line in their own campaign rhetoric. But what, say, Ocasio-Cortez is talking about with the Green New Deal or Medicare for All is really having a more fair economy in their definition of things And what that looks like is that the basic necessities are provided for everyone. So there's going to be a lot of debate on that going into 2020 with these candidates who are running now. Bernie Sanders is quite popular, actually. His ideas are very progressive. He describes himself as a democratic socialist. But so far, his ideas and him as a person, he's fairly popular. So it will be very interesting to see how this plays out.
So what conservatives worry about is the idea of socialized medicine. That's been the phrase that's been used forever. And that's what they were worried about with health care. It was the boogeyman where mm-hmm. it was just going to be government mandated health care. Medicare for all is now the key word. There are other things that they point to and they say they don't want to see an evolution to an autocratic form of government. And they point at places like, any of your South American, Venezuela is a great example of it. But this isn't that necessarily, is it?
This is not quite that. And I don't think any self-described socialists or democratic socialists would say that they want something like Venezuela. I talked to a handful of not only self-described socialists, but historians and economists who describe themselves as aligning with some variation of socialism. And they point more to what we see in Denmark, in Sweden, some of these European countries that do have just more of a generous welfare state that are some sort of mixed economy a little bit with some socialist policies along with democracy. So that is really what, if you listen to what Bernie Sanders is talking about, he's looking more to that. Not quite as much to Venezuela. Now, is there such a thing as a pure socialist government? Well, you know, one could argue that we've never seen quite that, nor is the U.S. necessarily a purely capitalist country. So there are plenty of interesting discussions to be had.
CBS's Katie Watson, thanks. You're listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. Democratic Senator Doug Jones of Alabama has written a book about the 1963 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham. It's a case that he was later involved in as a federal prosecutor. Our Steve Dorsey sat down with him to talk about the book and the case.
Tell me about the years this was a cold case, this 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, and why it took so long for many of the victims and families affected by that bombing to receive justice.
Well, you know, the first of these cases was actually tried in 1977, about 14 years after the fact. Then Alabama Attorney General Bill Baxley prosecuted a guy named Robert Chambliss, known as Dynamite Bob, for the murder of Denise McNair, one of the four girls that died in this blast. And I was in law school, and I cut classes and went and watched that. And I think after that, people just kind of, you know, these are cold cases, and you have to wait on new evidence. And there's a lot of unsolved homicides in this country. And there were things that just happened, that started happening in the 90s, when over in Mississippi in particular, when the Medgar Evers murder was resurrected, and they got a conviction of Byron De La Beckwith. The Vernon Dahmer murder got a conviction of Sam Bowers, a former Klan leader in Mississippi. And all of a sudden, you get people and, new generation of both prosecutors and investigators who believe, you know, we can go back. We can go back in time and look at this and get a fresh set of eyes and ears. And more importantly, I think a new jury, a jury that has grown up in a different era, that is not going to bring the same kind of prejudicial baggage in evaluating the cases. And that's what really prompted this. There was a series of things in Birmingham that caused them to reopen this case, and I came in 1997 to take it from there. And we just came in and had an incredible team of just dedicated people who just wouldn't take no for an answer. They just, every time we got down, somebody would pull us back up, and it was just a remarkable team effort.
What were the roles of the two former KKK members you earned convictions of, Edwin Blanton Jr. and Bobby Cherry?
Well, to be honest with you, it's very difficult to say. You know, we were able to put the pieces of this puzzle together enough to get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. But the specific roles, we really couldn't tell, because we never got any cooperation from any of the former Klansmen, any of the wives, anybody that may have really fully known the specific details. We believe certainly that Blanton drove the car. We had a witness that saw his car behind the church a little bit around 2 o'clock in the morning, that Sunday morning. So we believe he was in the car. There was some other evidence that we had of a chase that the Birmingham police had given during that time with his car. Cherry was known to have some experience in explosives and munitions, and we believe he helped potentially make the bomb, but we're not sure. We had informant information that he worked on a fuse. He talked about it some. But to be honest with you, the real specific details of who did what and where and when, we'll probably never know, because no one would fully come forward to help us. It was really pieces of a puzzle that put together that showed the picture of these guys' guilt.
Alabama Democratic Senator Doug Jones, author of the book Bending Toward Justice, speaking with CBS News' Steve Dorsey. Still to come on the program, the death of actor Luke Perry at the age of 52 is focusing fresh attention on strokes. More on that coming up. You're listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup,
I'm Bill Rakoff. 5 days after suffering a massive stroke at his home, Beverly Hills 90210 star Luke Perry died last Monday at the age of 52. Perry was surrounded by friends and family when he died. More on his career from Entertainment Tonight's Kevin Frazier.
If the city of Beverly Hills wasn't already famous around the world.
You know, the tragedy of this country is that cretins like you two end up running it?
Luke Perry helped put it on the map by playing bad boy heartthrob Dylan McKay between 1990 and 2000. Condolences from his friends and 90210 co-stars flooded the internet Monday. Ian Ziering tweeted, "I will forever bask in the loving memories we've shared over the last 30 years.
That is a bad guy. Can we go, please?"
In the midst of his TV stardom, Perry tried to avoid typecasting, first starring in the big screen version of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, then playing a world champion bull rider in the film 8 Seconds.
Your mom and I are trying to decide between pizza and Chinese food.
He made a successful return to television in early 2017, playing the father of the main character in Riverdale. The show temporarily shut down production on Monday.
You guys are going to the dance together?
We were talking about it.
Real life fatherhood inspired him to change his health regimen after a cancer scare 4 years ago.
I'm a father of 2 children. I want to be with them as long as I can. I want to have as healthy a life as I can, spend as much time with them.
His death cut that time tragically short and came as a shock to anyone who remembers him as the youthful rebel who epitomized the 1990s.
Like all television series, 902 will come and it will go. You know, there's going to come a day when they're going to say, "That's it. That's your last episode."
That's ET's Kevin Frazier. CBS News medical correspondent Dr. Taryn Arula spoke with CBS this morning about Luke Perry's relatively young age and whether it was uncommon for stroke victims.
So I think one of the misconceptions is that strokes are a disease of the elderly. But what I want to convey is that this can happen to anyone at any age. And while we know that the risk of stroke does increase if you're over 65, right? 3/4 of strokes happen in populations over 65. The risk doubles every 10 years over the age of 55. There's still a fair percentage of people who have strokes in their younger ages. We also have seen an increase in the incidence of strokes in a younger population. Now, whether that's because we're diagnosing them more often or because there's an increase in risk factors, things like high blood pressure and obesity and diabetes that's driving it, it's really unclear. But the big message to young people is, look, you need to understand that you're at risk. Understand what your risk factors are, and importantly, recognize symptoms, because time is brain. Every minute that goes by in a large stroke, you lose 2 million brain cells, and this damage is irreversible. And so, you know, it's very important to act on symptoms, even if you think they go away, even if you think they're not a big deal, you need to get to the hospital, because our treatments require intervention in a short window of time.
Symptoms like what?
Symptoms like numbness or tingling in an arm or leg, inability to see well, or confusion or trouble walking, or difficulty with your speech, or facial droop, lack of coordination, massive headache, any of those things.
And 80% of strokes are preventable.
Yes.
Stop smoking.
Exactly. Yeah. So controlling blood pressure, which is very important, stopping smoking, controlling your weight, diet, exercise, all of the same things we talk about for heart disease.
Meanwhile, Dr. Narula reports that America's longest-running game show host, Alex Trebek of Jeopardy!, is facing a major health threat.
The longtime TV host will face his toughest battle.
This week, I was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Now, normally, the prognosis for this is not very encouraging, but I'm going to fight this.
Stage 4 pancreatic cancer is the most advanced type. Just 3% of people survive 5 years. Still, Trebek promised to beat it with his trademark wit.
Dr. Narula says late diagnoses make this particular form of cancer a challenge to recover from.
Pancreatic cancer is very difficult to detect, but research efforts are ongoing to find options to diagnose it earlier.
Dr. Narula says Trebek's odds aren't good, but his attitude is...
More than 56,000 Americans are expected to be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer this year. It's an aggressive disease, especially in later stages, but Trebek says he has no plans to let it stop him.
That's CBS's Dr. Tara Narula with CBS This Morning. In other news, the FDA is expected to approve the first new class of depression medication in decades. It is a nasal spray version of the drug ketamine, which is used in anesthesia. In powder form, though, it's also known as the party drug Special K. CBS's Dr. John LaPook reports.
More than 16 million American adults suffer from major depressive disorder. About 30% of them are treatment resistant. They live in pain that can be unbearable. Some are so desperate they may actually self-medicate with opiates or even turn to suicide. Now, a medication that's been around for 50 years could give hope to patients who could not find relief from current antidepressants.
Kayla Snyder is getting ready for an upcoming visit with her family. But less than a year ago, she couldn't even leave her apartment.
Every 3 to 6 months, I seem to have a severe depressive episode, which includes not getting out of bed for a week to 2 weeks, not showering, not eating.
Her childhood in New Jersey appeared to be happy, but things began to fall apart when Kayla left home for college.
I didn't know what I was doing in life, what my purpose was. I thought something was wrong with me.
Antidepressants didn't help much, and over the next 5 years, Kayla got so desperate she tried to kill herself 3 times. Then she started regular intravenous ketamine infusions at this New York City clinic, which connected us to Kayla.
I didn't have suicidal thoughts every day, which I used to have, and I just felt like a weight was lifted off my shoulders.
Traditional antidepressants work on neurotransmitters such as serotonin and norepinephrine that help nerves in the brain communicate. Ketamine targets a different one called glutamate and works much faster than drugs like Prozac, Cymbalta, or Zoloft.
What we've heard from patients who've gotten ketamine is that, wow, this is what it feels like to be normal. And they never thought they were going to feel that way again. So it's very dramatic.
Dr. Dennis Charney was one of the first to study ketamine infusion therapy and would get a share of any profits from the spray version.
Ketamine has been abused on the street where it's called Special K. How does it make people feel there?
What the individual is looking for when they take Special K is a feeling of highness, a out-of-body experience. And this, in general, is not a major issue when you take the lower doses that are needed to feel better from depression.
Each of Kayla's current ketamine treatments costs $475, and they are not reimbursed by insurance. If the FDA approves the nasal spray version, it will likely be covered. For Kayla, that's reason enough to see if it works just as well as the infusions.
It really helps your entire life, not just, oh, let's get high for an hour and then go back to a depressing life. It's more, it changes your life in a positive way.
This new esketamine spray called Spravato has to be administered under a doctor's supervision and is only for those who have failed at least 2 antidepressants. Dr. Charney says if antidepressants are working for you, stick with them.
CBS's Dr. John LaPook. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
What we want to try to do is give the American people the truth.
Jim Bridenstine, administrator of NASA. How close are we to space tourism?
I think we're very close.
Trump cabinet member Linda McMahon.
First time that I met Donald Trump was at a Rolling Stones concert.
Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff. We're talking with 48 Hours correspondent Peter Van Sant. This week's show deals with an American woman accused of killing a fellow teacher in South Korea. And Peter went and found this woman and talked with her. What an interesting story and a tease.
Yeah, this is a three-year, 48 Hours investigation into the murder of this beautiful young American teacher, Carolyn Abel, who was in South Korea, allegedly murdered by one of her colleagues, another American, at the school.
And this is an interesting thing because I was watching some of the previews for this just to set the stage for this. This was a group of teachers who were teaching in South Korea back in the, I guess, in the 80s, right around the time of the Seoul Olympics when South Korea was kind of emerging, if you will.
Yeah, it was 1988, and South Korea was emerging. They were a bit suspicious of Americans back then, and this group of Americans were very close socially. They hung out together after hours. They became close friends. They just would socialize basically with each other. And back on December 20th, 1988, Carolyn Abel, one of the teachers who was very popular, didn't show up at school, which was unlike her. She hadn't called in. So two of the teachers went over with several students to her apartment and made the grisly discovery. They found her body. She'd been stabbed more than 30 times, a shocking murder in South Korea. It made the national news. And the South Koreans were convinced that one of the Americans must have committed a crime like this because their citizens couldn't possibly do it. And it turns out they may be right.
So you begin the process of trying to track down the prime suspect in this case, who, as it turns out, essentially is hiding in plain sight.
One of the two women who found Carolyn Abel's body is a woman named Kathy Patrick. She left South Korea and went back to the United States. Korean police investigate. They eventually decide, along with a U.S. Army detective, that Kathy Patrick is the person who committed this murder. A warrant is issued for her arrest, but at the time there was no extradition treaty between the United States and South Korea, so they couldn't send her back to Korea. U.S. investigators talk to her in Seattle. She fails a lie detector test there, Kathy Patrick does. But at the time, if an American killed an American overseas, they could not be tried in the United States for that crime. So Kathy Patrick walked. She was never arrested. She's a suspect in this case. We track her down. She's now a counselor at Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington, which is north of Seattle. And we end up doing an unscheduled interview. She had declined an interview with us, so we went to her, and she actually answered about five questions in her office when we approached.
Interesting story that you'll be able to see on 48 Hours this week on the CBS television network, on your local affiliate, or you can always tune into CBSNews.com in 48 Hours to watch the episodes afterwards. Peter Van Sant, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. CBS News spent this week looking at the issues facing mothers around the world and here at home. The United States is the only country without a national dedicated family leave law. It's something that President Trump took note of in his State of the Union address.
I am also proud to be the first president to include in my budget a plan for nationwide paid family leave, so that every new parent has the chance to bond with their newborn child.
Six states and Washington, D.C. offer some form of family leave, but most American workers are at the mercy of their employers. CBS News' Alex Wagner taking a look at how much those company policies may vary.
Most industrialized countries offer at least 14 weeks of paid maternity leave. The only national parental leave policy in the U.S. is the now 26-year-old Family and Medical Leave Act. It guarantees workers job security for up to 12 weeks of time off, but there is no promise of a paycheck.
Before Finley arrived 4 weeks early via emergency C-section, Hannah Carden did her best to prepare.
Do you love him?
The Massachusetts emergency room nurse and mother of two took on extra shifts and even cashed out part of her 401k plan at a penalty to keep her family afloat during her 12 weeks of unpaid maternity leave.
Since everything that has been taught to me, no matter what happens, you never touch your retirement account because that's your account for later on.
Even that wasn't enough. Cardin's husband lost his job, her income tax refund was less than expected, and with just $500 to spare, she must now go back to work early, 10 weeks after giving birth to a premature baby.
What's your feeling about that?
It's definitely a defeating sort of feeling. You know, I definitely wanted to spend those extra 2 weeks recovering.
Across the country, in California and a world away, Marquita Staples Green is getting ready to welcome her second baby girl. As with her 1.5-year-old daughter, Emerald, Staples Green will take 26 weeks of fully paid leave offered by her employer, software firm Adobe.
And by the time I went back to work, I was ready. I was prepared. I had some time also to think about, here are some of my goals, and here's going to be my new normal as a working mom. I feel completely grateful, but I really wish that this was the norm.
Only 16% of Americans have access to paid leave through their employers, which is why so many women need to secure infant care within weeks of giving birth. Policymakers on both sides of the aisle are trying to change that.
The Democratic-sponsored Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act would give workers 12 weeks of partially paid leave funded by a payroll tax.
I'm not in favor of mandating this.
Republican Senator Marco Rubio is taking a different approach.
It's an option that people can use to sort of draw on their retirement savings from Social Security early. But it's certainly better than having to max out your credit cards or going on public assistance and leaving work.
Economists say paid leave programs have important economic benefits, like keeping women in the workforce who then can earn higher wages down the line. And a majority of Americans do support the idea of paid leave. It's only when costs are considered, whether it's higher taxes or a decrease in future benefits to pay for the leave, that enthusiasm decreases. In the meantime, Hannah Cardin is doing what she can to make sure her family thrives.
Eventually, you just kind of have to continue living with what you have. So the fact that I'm going back to work 2 weeks early, if I really harped on those things, and I could, I wouldn't get the things that I need to get done.
Right.
And
you're getting it done.
Exactly.
That's CBS's Alex Wagner reporting. And that's it for the weekend roundup. We hope you enjoyed it. Thanks so much for listening. We'd like to get your feedback. You can send us your thoughts and your story ideas to weekendroundup@cbsnews.com. And as always, you can find the program online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker, our technical supervisor. Christopher Buckley is the production assistant in New York. And Jake Rosen is our intern here in Washington. Have a great week. In for Steve Dorsey this week, I'm Bill Rakoff, CBS News.